It's horrible what's happening in the Ukraine. It's horrible what's happening in Gaza. But if you are not Jesus Christ or Superman, then the entire idea that you feel that it's your responsibility to change this reality means that there's something wrong with you. When people think that everything is their problem, in the end, nothing is their problem. I'm sure that you lost sleep over the war in Ukraine, but now you lose sleep over the war in Gaza. Not because people don't die in the Ukraine, it's just because you switched the reality show.
It's Shelf Life. On this episode, the absurdity and poignancy of human existence in Kurt Vonnegut's masterpiece, Slaughterhouse-Five, and in J.D. Salinger's Nine Stories, two books that have been chosen by my guest, Edgar Caret, the acclaimed short story writer whose brief, surreal stories encapsulate the complexities of living in Israel today.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Lawmakers in Alabama will hold a special session tomorrow following the Supreme Court ruling that race should not be a factor in drawing voting districts. Pat Duggins of Alabama Public Radio reports that puts one Democratic House member in the crosshairs.
Congressman Shomari Figures is up for re-election this November in Alabama. That is, assuming his district is still there. The U.S. Supreme Court ordered Alabama to create a second black House seat in 2023. Now those same justices say race doesn't matter. Figures has said he doesn't worry about the uncertainty.
We got elected to represent a certain part of the state of Alabama in District 2. And that's what we spend our time doing. I worry about things that I can control. I do not stress out about things that I cannot control.
Alabama's attorney general wants the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn an earlier injunction that keeps District 2's map in place until 2030. For NPR News, I'm Pat Duggins in Tuscaloosa, Alabama.
Members of OPEC Plus agreed today on a modest oil output in June. This is largely a symbolic gesture, as long as the Iran war disrupts Gulf oil supplies through the Strait of Hormuz. Even when shipping resumes, it will take several weeks, if not months, for supplies to return to normal. President Trump has said gas prices will drop after the war in Iran ends. Patrick DeHaan is the head of petroleum for Gas Buddy. He says it could take more than a year for prices to go back to pre-war levels. In the meantime, they continue to rise.
I would expect that the national average on Memorial Day would probably be somewhere in that $4.50 to $5 a gallon mark. And depending on where we go beyond that into the summer is contingent on whether or not the Strait of Hormuz reopens. And keep in mind, we are also now just a little over a month away from seeing the start of Atlantic hurricane season, another factor that could push prices to records later this summer.
He was interviewed on ABC. Ukrainian uncrewed vessels have struck two tankers in the Black Sea that are used to transport Russian oil. The Kremlin says the attacks could push global oil prices even higher. It's the latest in a series of strikes Ukraine's president says are targeting Russia's so-called shadow fleet. NPR's Hanna Palmarenko reports from Kyiv.
President Volodymyr Zelensky posted a video showing the sea drones striking the sterns of the vessels. The tankers were in the waters near the port of Novorossiysk in Russia. This is the third successful attack by Ukrainian sea drones in the past week. Earlier, two of the uncrewed vessels struck a sanctioned tanker southeast of Russian city of Tuapse. The next day, Ukrainian Navy struck two Russian patrol boats guarding the Kerch Bridge, which connects occupied Crimea with Russian territory. And in an attack by air, Ukrainian drones struck Primorsk Sunday, Russia's largest oil-exporting port on the Baltic Sea, sparking a fire. Hanna Polomarenko, NPR News, Kyiv.
This is NPR News. A search is underway for two U.S. service members missing during military exercises in Morocco yesterday. They were taking part in war games that began in April and stretch across four countries. The other countries are Tunisia, Ghana, and Senegal. The operation is called African Lion. It's an annual U.S. joint military exercise that usually features high-ranking military officials from the U.S. and its top African allies. Millions of Americans could now be considered Canadian under a new law expanding citizenship based on ancestry. Ari Snyder of Maine Public reports.
The change was sparked by a 2023 court ruling that Canada's one-generation limit on citizenship by descent was unconstitutional. Doug Cochran, a genealogist in Nova Scotia, says he's been swamped by research requests from people trying to prove Canadian ancestry. He prioritizes those coming from LGBTQ Americans.
Because people have a right to be who they are. And if they can't do it in the home country, well, come to Canada. We'll welcome you.
Canadian immigration authorities say in the six-week period after the law took effect in December, they received more than 12,000 proof of citizenship applications. For NPR News, I'm Ari Snyder in Portland, Maine.
The history was made at Horse Racing's Kentucky Derby last night. The winner was Golden Tempo. Cherie DeVoe was the first woman to train the winner of the first leg of the Triple Crown. She's just the second woman to train the winner of any of the three races. She said she never thought about the challenges of being a woman working in that sport, saying the racetrack is a tough place for anyone. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Amazon Business, committed to helping customers unlock smart business buying using AI for automating repetitive tasks to facilitate decision-making. Learn more at AmazonBusiness.com. This is NPR.
It's horrible what's happening in the Ukraine. It's horrible what's happening in Gaza. But if you are not Jesus Christ or Superman, then the entire idea that you feel that it's your responsibility to change this reality means that there's something wrong with you. When people think that everything is their problem, in the end, nothing is their problem. I'm sure that you lost sleep over the war in Ukraine, but now you lose sleep over the war in Gaza. Not because people don't die in the Ukraine, it's just because you switched the reality show.
Hello and welcome to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hedlund. Hello. Troubled soldiers scarred by the Second World War dominate the books in this episode of Shelf Life. They are Kurt Vonnegut's coruscating Slaughterhouse-Five and J.D. Salinger's slim collection, Nine Stories. War is never far away, either in the work of my guest, Etgar Karet, one of Israel's most popular authors, both at home and abroad, a writer of surreal short stories that can pinch as hard as they tickle. Karet, the son of Holocaust survivors, doesn't shy away from confronting the contradictions and failures of Israeli society. Born against the odds after doctors advised his mother that he wouldn't survive, his name, Etgar, means challenge in Hebrew. And true to his name, his work dares his readers to interrogate their complacency. He has said, "I think as a writer, my power is to take something that seems to be simple and show it as more complex and ambiguous." Etgar Karet, welcome to Shelf Life.
Hi. First, I must give the honest disclosure that I never do shows that are talking about books, and that just because I know you and I like you, I'm doing it, but it's not something rational, it's an instinct. But I think that in the bottom line, it comes from the fact that this idea that as a writer, you're an expert of books, you're inspired by books, you write books and you live in books, is just against the way that I see literature, which is this kind of place of total freedom in which you are not confined to anything and in which you are not a member of a guild, but you're just kind of a human being and you can be influenced by Kafka or by your grandmother's funny walk or by something that you ate, you know. Why can't I speak about your haircut? I feel like speaking about your haircut right now. And I thought that writing is about going where my heart tells me. So this is just the honest disclosure. And I'll go back to talking about the book, of course.
I love that honest disclosure. And I'm completely happy to talk about my haircut. But I guess I assume that if you write books, the chances are that you're doing a lot more reading than most people.
I don't agree with this assumption, really, because I think that if you write a lot, it means that you encounter many stories. Mm. And those stories can be propelled by the fact that you work in an insurance company and you talk to a lot of pissed people who tell you incredible stories. And it could be because you had a very difficult childhood. You know, my books come from books, from songs, from a joke somebody told me, you know, from falling into a puddle, you know, all of those things can inspire stories. And I feel that there is something about this idea of kind of connecting writing to reading that makes books more exclusive than they should feel. If I meet somebody and he says, I have an incredible story that I want to write, I say, write it. And if they say, I never read a book in my life, I say, okay, give it a try anyway.
I think that's very egalitarian of you. I mean, everyone is capable of being a writer. Everyone has stories. I'm in a writing class. And what I'm learning in that writing class is really to unlearn, to strip away all my tendency to want to edit, to overthink a sentence before I write it. It's so much about going with your subconscious, in a sense. You will find the story, you will find the path.
I always remember this bit in the Naked Lunch where William Burroughs, he reaches this checkpoint with soldiers. And the soldiers ask him, what is your profession? And he says, I'm a writer. And they say, do you have any proof of that? And he takes out a pen and he says, I carry a writing device. And I think that for me, this is the most honest and precise way of characterizing a writer, because a writer is somebody who writes something. Talker is somebody who says something. The fact that you are performing this action doesn't assume anything except for the fact that you have an urge to tell something. I taught once in NYU, and in the US, you have the concept of the well-written story. And when I talk to my students, I encourage them to experiment with what I call the badly written good story. And the thesis that I had behind it is that the best story I've heard in my life were not necessarily by people who were very proficient in telling stories. And maybe their English wasn't very good. And maybe they didn't read a lot of books. But they had a story that they thought I really needed to hear. And this is the essential thing. And I think that as a writer, more than you need to build up, you know, your position as a writer or your knowledge as a writer, you basically should seek a story that you really, really, really feel that you need to tell.
Mm. Is that the sort of the bottom line for you, that I have a story, I need to tell it? Is it as simple as that?
It's not as simple as that. I'm saying I have something I need to share. I'm going to give it a try. And you know, when we're talking about Saturday House 5 by Kurt Vonnegut, I really think that this is a very extreme example of this line of thinking. Because, you know, whenever I try to sell somebody the book and I say, hey, you know, this book is really a heartbreaking autobiography and a sci-fi book. And this for me is really like saying, you know, sometimes you desperately need to get out of a room. So you try to break the door and you can't break it. So you try to find the tool. So you pick a hammer or you pick an axe or you pick a broom. You use whatever you have to kind of get out. So I try to pass any obstacle in my way with whatever I can find. I will write it in rhymes. I will draw you a little drawing. I will do whatever it takes. Because I'm not here to defend the form. I'm just using the form so you can get me, you know, that guy who's on the other side.
Interesting that Vonnegut did write a book that, in a sense, can't be pinned down by our need in this age to put everything into an algorithm, to shelve everything in a neat category. Like it is, as you say, sci-fi, but it is memoir. It's historical fiction. If you were in a bookstore, it'd be very hard to know where to shelve it. Is that for you one of the successes of this book, that it jumps through time, it gives a sci-fi memoir, extraordinary pathos, that makes it one of a kind? I can't think of another book that is like this.
I don't think it's the success of the book, but I think it's the side effect of the success of this book. Mm. And I think that the success of this book is really following your feelings and stories and not following, in a sense, any genre or literary expectations. Many times when you write, you're basically there to celebrate your individuality, to tell your story. But it's very, very easy to surrender yourself to expectations. Like, I like sports. And sometimes I see athletes giving interviews after games. And the amazing thing is that when you see them on the court, let's say basketball players, they're very, very much like individuals. they're playing in different ways. They have different characters. They treat the team differently. Mm-hmm. But usually when they get interviewed, they always say the same thing. I may have scored a lot of points, but it's the entire team that had won. Or next week, it's going to be a different ball game. And even their posture becomes kind of more petrified, as if now they're playing the role of somebody being interviewed after a game.
Mm-hmm.
There is something there that kind of traps them. And I think that as a writer, many times there's something in this writer's identity that can trap you. This idea that you have to say something important, that you have to be original, that people have to understand that you're sophisticated and educated. But at the bottom line, sometimes you want to say, pass me the ketchup, you know?
This is Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. And my guest for this episode is the Israeli author Edgar Caret. We're discussing Kurt Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse-Five. Edgar, there's a section early in Slaughterhouse-Five in the sort of preamble to the story where Vonnegut tells us about a meeting he has with a film director. And the film director says, I don't understand why people write anti-war books. You might as well write an anti-glacier book. And Vonnegut thinks about this and says he's right. There's always going to be glaciers, although that's questionable these days. There's always going to be glaciers. There's always going to be war. And writing a book isn't going to stop it. That book came out during the Vietnam War, though it was about the Second World War. And we're talking about it now during the war in Gaza. There is a sense, right, in which this book is always relevant because we were always at war. Is that part of what gives the novel such power for you as a fellow writer, as a reader, as a person, as an Israeli living in a country that has been at conflict since its foundation, that this book doesn't lose its relevance because human beings are human beings. We fight.
You know, I don't even read it as an anti-war book. I think that the things that it does, it says that the great tragedy does not negate complexities. Let's say if we're in a mundane situation, you say, oh, things are very complex. But the moment that people start killing each other, you say, oh, that's simple. They're the good guys. They're the bad guys. This should be done. This shouldn't be done. And I think that if the book is anti-something, is basically anti this reduction or anti-idea that you should be for or against everything in this world. That you should have a very strong and extreme and clear opinion. And that if you find yourself accepting arguments from both sides, then this doesn't mean that you're dumb. It just means that you're thinking and you're trying to make up your mind. So I think that this relevancy of this book is not only that it's a book that is relevant for war and wartime and for a country that right now, you know, really is a in kind of a survival mode that can many times clash, you know, with my values and my ideas. But I think also a book against everything that social media stands for. I think it's really a book that gives you this kind of legitimation to say something obscure and complex and say, maybe we had to do it, but at the same time, this is horrible. You know, the ability to kind of build this kind of argument and that it would be powerful and functioning, for me, it's like seeing a dinosaur. Mm. You know, nobody these days would have the guts to write something like that.
It really goes to my introduction to you as a writer who believes that the power of your work is to take something that might seem simple and show it as complex and ambiguous. I'm reminded of an editorial that you wrote for the New York Times in 2016, where you essentially said the same thing, that it's preposterous to say I'm anti-Israel or anti-Palestine or pro-Israel or pro-Palestine. It immediately assumes if you say I'm pro-Israel that you're pro-innocent Palestinians being killed, or if you're pro-Palestine, you're pro-Hamas, and that actually these things are infinitely more complex and nuanced.
Yeah, I find it's basically annoying when somebody says to me I'm pro-Israeli. Then it's basically this honest disclosure. Whatever you're going to say, I'm not going to change my mind. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit like, I don't know, saying I'm a fanatic religious person, you know, just so you know. Okay, I know. I'll be careful.
You grew up hearing stories from your parents, both survivors of the Holocaust. Your mother was in the Warsaw Ghetto. Your father lived for 2 years in a hole in the ground in which he couldn't lie down straight and he couldn't stand up. So he was in a sort of sitting position for 2 years. When he came out, his muscles had atrophied so much he had to be lifted out of the hole. What's interesting about Slaughterhouse-Five for me is that it tells the story of an atrocity against the Germans, primarily, although there are references to what happens in the extermination camps. But really, it's a story of the Allies bombing Dresden, which makes it unusual in the sort of history of literature of the Second World War. How does that challenge some of our tendencies to want to view everything in pure black and white terms?
Yeah, so I don't think that what Vonnegut did was something kind of supportive of the German side. I think that this was something that was supportive of a humanist perspective. And I think that it's all around the human book. It's kind of basically says it wouldn't be nice if human beings would be less disgusting, you know? And I think that the lesson that I got, especially for my mother always insisted that her personal story will be a personal story. And in that sense, will not be part of the big Holocaust narrative. So the idea is that for my mother, she wasn't this kind of a pebble or a jigsaw puzzle from the Holocaust that by telling her story and everybody telling that same story, they would tell together the big story of the Holocaust. For her, she was like a movie star in a period movie. And she was unlucky enough to be a movie star in a period film that takes place in the crappiest period in the 20th century and maybe in the history. But her perspective was not a perspective of a Jew or of a victim. It was a perspective of a human being in a certain situation. You know, I remember that one of the stories that she told that when they ran from their town, they ran to Warsaw from a village because they thought it would be safer in Warsaw. And so when they ran from their little town or village, the Germans were after them. And her mother that was carrying my mom, that was a young child, and her little brother that was a baby, realized that she can't escape. So she took them into a cabbage field and they lie down in the cabbage field, hoping that when the Germans would pass, they won't notice that there are people hiding them. And while they were hiding, her baby brother started crying. So her mother breastfed the baby so he won't cry. My mother said, we were lying in the field and the sun came out and it was really, really beautiful. And the sun was really on my face. And my mom was putting an arm on me and breastfeeding my brother, who was so cute, and everything was beautiful. And then there was a shadow over us. And when I looked up, I saw that there was a Nazi soldier, that they were probably supposed to go through the fields to see if there are people in the field. And she said, the Nazi soldier, he looked at my mom, and he looked at the baby, and he looked at me, and we were so happy and so shining and so glowing that he basically ran away. We were so human that it kind of sent him all the way back to Berlin, this guy. And there was something about the way that she told this story. You know, this was not a story about victimhood, and this was not a story about Nazis. This was really a story about a mother and a child trying to hide from forces that are actually not even what's written on the brochure. That Nazi guy didn't want to kill them. He was supposed to kill them. You know, I saw the movie. But he didn't. That's the kind of thing that I think that when we tell the big narrative, they tend to be very, very reductive. But when we zoom in, we can see a lot of things in it. You know, we talk a lot about this issue of responsibility these days. Let's say you would never use the services of a company that is a racist or anti-Semitic, right? Or that promotes homophobic contents or hate crime. But you use Instagram and Facebook. They make their living out of it. Facebooks are evil, but you're using them to spread a message of love. So you're using something wrong to do something right. So are you wrong? Are you right? I don't know. That's life. And that's what I learned from my parents. Tell your story. Don't tell the story that you read in some book.
You're listening to Shelf Life with me, Aaron Hicklin, and my guest, Edgar Corret, the author of The Seven Good Years, The Bus Driver Who Wanted to Be God, and most recently, Fly Already. Edgar, we are talking about Slaughterhouse-Five by Kurt Vonnegut. We can't have this conversation without talking about the parallel between Slaughterhouse-Five and what's happening in Gaza. Is that a parallel that is fair?
Look, I think every parallel is fair. It just the question is of thinking what's similar and what's different. For me, I think that the way that I relate most to this is that I find myself in a kind of a Vonnegut position, looking at things, saying that, you know, I can agree with the narrative that we need to retaliate, you know, that we need to get the kidnapped back. We need to show Hezbollah in Lebanon that they should not try and do something like that. Gaza is not Dresden in that sense that there is a terrorist organization that has more than 40,000 people inside the city with an infrastructure and with support of the local civilians who do not have an alternative. And they are holding hostages and they are directly responsible for the murder of more than 1,000 Israelis. But I'm saying in the bottom line, this is countered by the simple fact that you see thousands of dead civilians, you know, and that's something that one cannot accept. But having said that, doesn't necessarily mean that I possess a better solution, you know. And that's the thing. I think that, you know, that we live in an age where everybody's an expert. Everybody has an opinion. But I feel that sometimes I can say, this is not right, and I don't know what's right. I give you an American example that I'm not comparing it to what's happening in Israel, but just kind of talking about the idea of complexities, you know. Many people talk about the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Arguably, if the US would not have bombed Hiroshima and Nagasaki, by now there would be another incident in which atomic weaponry would be used. It's just the fact that it was used and it was so horrible that people don't do it again. But I'm saying that when you think about what happened, you could ask yourself all kinds of questions. Ah, okay, so throwing the bomb made the Japanese surrender, so it actually saved a lot of Japanese lives and American lives, as many people like to say. But wouldn't they have surrendered if you only threw one bomb? Would have they surrendered if you threw one bomb in the water next to them? In the end, everything is speculative and everything is complex. I can't agree with anyone saying what's happening in Gaza, it's the way that it should be done. Because no way in which it should be done should have thousands of people dying, you know. I can't look at this thing and clap, you know. I'm not a war expert. I'm not a terrorist expert. I see myself as somebody who knows a thing or two about pain and suffering. And I say that, you know, there should be a lot of thinking. It's not a reality show. The solutions are not people giving their opinions. That's, I think, the great corruption of social media. It's like when people change their Facebook photo to an Ukrainian flag, they have a sense that they're helping the Ukrainian people. But the Ukrainian people would rather have a blanket or a bottle of mineral water than us having the flag in our Facebook page. So I really feel that a lot of the activities that we're doing are all about being aggressive and arguing and standing up and doing this and doing that. But in the bottom line, what is the outcome? You know, okay, so you go in the street and you yell from the river to the sea and that Zionists should be thrown in the garbage bag of history. I disagree with you. But what saddens me more is that as a liberal, I see how those actions in Europe and the US actually help and justify Islamophobia. That is totally wrong. But when you see a picture of a violent demonstration, when a Jew dies in LA, when this happens, this propels this kind of hate and extremism from the other side. And I'm saying that, you know, I really, really long for the days that activism was when you want to help people in Palestine. You go and work in the fields with them. This is the kind of activism that I grew up on, you know?
Yeah, yeah. When the bombing of Mariupol in Ukraine was underway, I would literally dream, of how maybe if 100,000 of us all marched to Mariupol, it would bring an end to that bombing. Like, how could the Russians continue to bomb Mariupol if we went and stood together, hundreds of thousands of people all taking over the street.
But I tell you something really, really blunt, Aaron. You know, it's horrible what's happening in the Ukraine. It's horrible what's happening in Gaza. But if you are not Jesus Christ or Superman, then the entire idea that you feel that it's your responsibility to change this reality means that there's something wrong with you. I'm not talking specifically about you. I'm talking about this age. When people think that everything is their problem, in the end, nothing is their problem. I'm sure that you lost sleep over the war in Ukraine. But now you lose sleep over the war in Gaza. Not because people don't die in Ukraine. It's just because you switched the reality show. You know, Ukraine goes for the third season. We are still in the first season. We have more rating. By next year, you won't sleep because people would die somewhere else. And I'm saying, you should get some sleep, Aaron, because you won't be of any use of us for us if you don't sleep. So the whole idea is to understand what your role is in it. And I'm saying, if you can help, help who you can. Just don't think that everything in this universe is on you, you know. All those people who go and throw tomato soup at the Mona Lisa because of global warming. What are you representing, you know? Are you representing tomato soup? Are you representing future mankind? It's just people doing something and feeling very full of themselves because they're being documented by media that is propelled by anything that is extreme and violent, you know? If I would be able to move through my microphone, come out at the other end, yeah, and bite your nose, you don't believe how many listeners you have for this podcast. Regardless of what we said, and I'm saying that really this is a very challenging time. You know, I started a newsletter, and the reason that I started the newsletter was that I realized that the old solutions were not working anymore. I can't use the big system. I can't talk to the entire world. The only thing I can do is basically do stuff bottom up and say, hey guys, this is what I write. This is what I talk about. If you want, you can get my mail. If you don't, go and buy some other people's book. Go and spend your time doing something else. And I really feel that this is really the bunker period for artists. It's not about getting into the New York Times bestseller list. It's this ability to be able to work in an environment where you can write what you want and believe in and have enough people who support it. This is as good as it gets, and it doesn't matter who you are right now. You know, we are not living in the age of Philip Roth and Bernard Malamud. It's not as if like there is this vibrating intellectual scene and everybody reads a book. You just need to go there and find out the couple of hundred thousand people agree to engage with you in a certain kind of dialogue.
I want to make a little defense of Aaron Hicklin sitting here before you punch my nose for ratings. You know, I started my life as a journalist. I covered the war in Bosnia because I was idealistic. I was passionate. I felt that writers had an obligation and a responsibility. And I think you do too, to remind people of their humanity, to remind people that they have an obligation to check their worst impulses. And your writing is full of that. And a piece I wanted to read from, Just Another Sinner, which is in The Seven Good Years, your memoir in these sort of beautiful but brief essays. You talk about going to a writer's retreat in New Hampshire. You're expected to read one evening around the fire or wherever with a bunch of other writers. And one of them stands up and reads, and you are stunned. And I'm going to pick this up here and just read for a second. I don't remember exactly what I read that evening, only that throughout the reading, her story was reverberating through my mind. In that story, a father is speaking to his children who are spending their summer vacation torturing animals. He tells them that there is a line that separates killing bugs from killing frogs, and that no matter how hard it is, that line must never be crossed. Such is the way of the world. The writer didn't create it, but he's here to say what needs to be said. There is a line that separates killing bugs from killing frogs, and even if the writer has crossed it during his life, he still has to point it out. The writer is neither saint, nor sadic, nor prophet, standing at the gate. He's just another sinner who has a somewhat sharper awareness and uses slightly more precise language to describe the inconceivable reality of our world. He doesn't invent a single feeling or thought. All of them existed long before him. He's not the least bit better than his readers. Sometimes he's a lot worse, and so it should be. if the writer were an angel, the abyss that separates him from us would be so great that his writing couldn't get close enough to touch us. But because he's here, at our side, buried up to his neck in mud and filth, he's the one who, more than anyone else, can share with us everything that's going on in his mind, in the lit-up areas, and especially in the dark recesses. He won't take us to the promised land, he won't bring peace to the world or heal the sick, but if he does his work right, a few more virtual frogs will get to live. The bugs, I'm sorry to say, will have to manage on their own. Now, you kind of end that short essay by saying that this is a truth you know, but that you'd sort of fallen away from that. And it was a kind of reminder to you of the imperative to write, why you write. And that night you go back to your room and you start writing again.
I know, I can tell you which story I wrote that night.
Oh, really? Which one?
It's a story called The Island, and it's one of my favorites. So I owe this reading my story.
But I read that and I was like, here's a writer absolutely telling us why he writes and the imperative to write and to bring people, bring readers, some readers, if not all readers, to, I would say, a place of compassion.
Yes. No, I totally agree with that. I think that, let's say, there is a sense that when I look at my purpose as a writer, I think they are both very humble and extremely ambitious. Because I think they're ambitious from the sense that I really want to feel that I have some kind of an intimate dialogue with my reader. I really, really want to have this kind of dialogue that something from it stays with you long after you've read the book. But at the same time, it doesn't have to be a life-changing advice, you know? It could be just saying to you, hey, you know, when you sit in the bar, never take the last seat because the barman will always bump into you. This is also words of wisdom. It's good enough for me. It is this purpose of kind of trying to make people see things in a different way so they'll be better people or that they would suffer less. But at the same time, all this is done on a very, very minor level. You know, when I taught in the US, I spoke to my students in the first class and I asked them, what is your purpose in writing? And about half of them said that they want to write the great American novel. And I said to them that if I would sit down trying to write the great American novel, I would never get over the first sentence because no first sentence would seem to be good enough to start the great American novel. But if you just scribble something on a piece of paper, maybe something great will come of it. You know, even in the text that you quoted, it's not about saving the words. It's about that if you're lucky, they'll kill one less frog. I would want to save the bugs too, but I can do very little. And when I enter this discourse in a very humble manner, it really helps me to be more, let's say, honest. I'm not looking at the mirror or thinking what my elementary school teacher wanted me to be. I'm just what I am.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. And my guest for this episode is the Israeli author Edgar Caret. We'll be back after this.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Seminary Hill, open Friday through Sunday in Calicoon, featuring dinner with a view, live music on Fridays, and weekend brunch. Tours and tastings every Saturday at 11 a.m., and Catskill's Ciderfest returns on Saturday, May 9th. Tickets available on Resy. More information at seminaryhill.co. From generous funding from the Public Media Bridge Fund, and from listeners like you, who donate at wjffradio.org.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, Epic Systems maintains health records for more than 80% of Americans.
I think most of us who work here would hesitate to go to a place that doesn't have our software because they realize it does help save lives.
We visit Judy Faulkner, the unusual founder and CEO of an unusual company. That's next time on Freakonomics Radio. Tuesday afternoon at 2 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. And my guest for this episode is the Israeli author Edgar Caret. We're talking about two among his favorite books, including Nine Stories by J.D. Salinger and Slaughterhouse-Five by Kurt Vonnegut. Edgar, I'm struck by the fact that the two authors you're talking about today, Kurt Vonnegut and J.D. Salinger, were both war veterans. They both served in the Second World War, and you're a war veteran. How does that experience make itself felt in their work? And I'm not talking about the sort of literal way that it's felt in Slaughterhouse-Five, which is about war, but in the way they write, do you think, that sort of existential experience of being at war?
Yes, so I must say that unlike Putin Salinger, my army service was not in a war zone, but it was still very traumatic because I lost my best friend. My best friend killed himself during our joint service, and I found him after he shot himself. And what I can say is that the things that I recognize as writers is something that I recognize in myself, that they used writing as a mean of survival. You know, I can also feel this in other writers. I don't know, the first one that comes to mind, for example, is Kafka or Janet Frame, that they are both writers that I like a lot. That there is something, when you read the writing, you feel that there is something so essential in it and so desperate in it that first and foremost, you say those people wrote not to become any crazier, not to kill themselves. You know, let's say when I read Metamorphosis by Kafka, I really don't see it as somebody say, oh, I had this brilliant idea. Yeah, this guy wakes up as a cockroach. You have a feeling that a person who has this kind of a story in himself, if he won't be able to put it out, he'll be in a problem. And if he put it out and nobody would read it, he would still be in a 10 times better place where he would have been before he was able to realize that story. So I think that I like those writers that I feel that they are kind of writing for themselves more than they are writing for the reader.
I like the reference to Kafka and the cockroach because I was reading The Seven Good Years and there's a story about your son Lev telling you that he's a cat and that this absolves him from responsibility for, I think, hitting someone at school, if I remember the essay correctly. It reminded me of the short story in Fly Already, where a young boy thinks he's a cat. Reading those two side by side sort of showed your creative process of taking something in real life and then embellishing it and seeing where that takes you.
I don't know if we have the time, but if you want, I can tell you a story about how I wrote my latest story.
Yes, I'd love to hear it.
So since the 7th of October, I found it very difficult to write. And I also engaged in many activities of meeting survivors, meeting doctors, meeting social workers, and you know. And one day I was speaking to my sister, and my sister, she's an ultra-Orthodox Jew. She has 11 children, more than 50 grandchildren at the age of 60. And it was the first time we spoke since the war started. And she was telling me how much she's been praying since the war had started. She lives very close to the Western Wall. She walks there. She keeps praying. She has lists. She prays for many things. She prays for certain people, general people, the Jewish people, the Palestinian people. She has a lot of, you know, praying to do. And she was talking about that while I was still dealing with personal loss of people I knew, you know, and this kind of pride that she had in her praying a lot really annoyed me. And my sister never annoys me. She's really like the most amazing people I know. We never had a fight since I was a child. But I said to her, Lucy, listen, I don't know why. I feel very impatient. You know, I'm not nice. Let's talk some other time. She said, sure. And then I have this mechanism that sometimes when I feel myself alienated from a person, I sit down and I write a story from what I think is their way of thinking. And most of the time, a very bad story comes out of it, but it helps me feel better. I can tell you that I wrote more than a dozen stories about Netanyahu. You know, one of them is called The Best Liar in the World, in which I try to be the person so I can get somewhere, but it never worked with him. But with my sister, it was very easy. And I wrote a story about this person who really wants to pray well enough that he can save the region, that he can free all the kidnapped, you know, spare the people in Gaza. He just has to pray well enough, because it kind of reminded me the naivety of my sister. And by the time I ended writing this story, what I felt was that I didn't write a story about my sister. I wrote a story about myself, because the things that religious people and writers have in common, we both engage in a dialogue in which we have to believe that the other side exists. That when my sister prays, she has to believe that somebody's listening. And when I write my story, I have to believe that there will be somebody who gets them. And I think that both those beliefs are really unbased, but that without them, we can't go anywhere. It's called Intention. It was published in The Guardian. And I felt there was something in it that it kind of healed something in it. This kind of feeling of speaking to her over the phone and thinking that I'm better than her totally disappeared. I called her and I was as warm as I was before, because I understood that we're both people who need to believe that something exists to survive.
You're listening to Shelf Life with me, Aaron Hicklin, and my guest, the Israeli author, Edgar Caret. Edgar, Slaughterhouse-Five is full of beautiful vignettes, really, of people who come and go and disappear and moments of reprieve. But what I really found affecting in it is his use of language. There's a moment where he describes the humiliated Americans being marched to a prisoner of war camp as a river. Through the valley flowed a Mississippi of humiliated Americans. I love that line. And there's beautiful echoes. He talks about the soldiers nestling like spoons on the German trains to the camps. And then later you get an echo of that when Billy, after the war, is nestling in bed with his wife, again like a spoon. But I was just struck by how gorgeous his language use is. I think my favorite single moment is when Billy Pilgrim is on a spaceship to Tralfamador. These are the sequences that sort of interrupt the Dresden story and then the American sort of 50s, 60s vignettes in which Billy Pilgrim is abducted by aliens. And on the spaceship to Tralfamador, he wants to read. And they only have one book in English. It's being transported to Tralfamador to be added to a museum, an exhibition of human life. And the book is Valley of the Dolls by Jacqueline Suzanne. And I just laughed out loud at that.
I think that this is a wonderful metaphor for, the distance between a micro-living life and summing it up. In the end, some alien race are going to pick some random book and say, this was what humanity was. We shouldn't work on trying to make them pick the right book. We should just be able to survive here and not be nasty to each other until we die, and then they can pick whichever books they want.
Of all the scenes in Slaughterhouse-Five, Edgar, is there one section that is a particular joy to you, a particular favorite?
There is something in its introduction that really shows you how humble and desperate is the role of a writer. When you read the introduction to the book, you really, really realize that Kurt Vonnegut wanted to read this book more than any person in the world would want to read it. He wanted to write it because that he could not exist without writing it. And I think that there is something about the entire descriptions in the book that are very, very humbling, you know, not only toward Americans or soldiers, but toward human beings in general. This kind of anthropologist anger on them, because, you know, Vonnegut study anthropology, this idea of kind of seeing us as creatures or species or molecules hitting each other almost randomly and finding the sadness and also the comfort in that. When I grew up, I always saw art as something very snobbish, that the artist would be like kind of like those secular priests saying they know something that I don't know. They access some kind of sphere of knowledge that I don't have. And I think that in the end, it's writers like Vonnegut or Kafka that I find something very humble in their writing, or writers like Salinger or Carver or Cheever, that they start with something that feels like a very humble attempt, you know, a conversation between a grown-up and a child, a guy who tells kids in a summer camp an ongoing story that he makes up. There is something about all those kind of stakes that seem to be very low, in a sense. And the fact that they're low makes them super high, because in the end, it's not somebody who wants to make you be nicer to minorities. It's somebody who wants you to look in the mirror and understand what a weird and strange thing it is to be a human being.
Well, since you introduced Salinger there, let's talk quickly about Nine Stories by J.D. Salinger, which was published in 1953, famous for A Perfect Day, for Banana Fish, and for Esme with Love and Squalor. You know, Salinger published most of his stuff in a very brief window of about 15 years, from 1948 to 1963, and then stopped. He lived until 2010 when he was 91. But we don't really have anything from the later part of his life. What we do have are these exquisite short stories in which I felt that I was being dropped into these tableaus almost, or sketches. They had started some way before I got there, and they would finish sometime after I left. And I was just sort of dropped into these moments in people's lives.
My personal favorite is, again, I'm translating from Hebrew, the laughing man or the laughing person.
This is one narrated by a member of a boys' club, and it recounts the sort of tales of the laughing man, who is the kind of club's chief, right? As his life deteriorates, so do the stories.
I think it's a brilliant, as poetic story, because basically, you know, in the story, the narrator, this kind of a youth group leader who tells the group an ongoing story which he made up. And of course, this story is affected by his mood. And when he has a girlfriend, then there is something a little bit positive. But when the girlfriend dumps this guy, this starts to destroy the entire imaginary romantic words that he creates in his story. And I think that there is something in this story that tells something beautiful about the relationship between a writer and his or her work. Because the kids that listen to the story, they're like readers. And they experience, through the story told to them, the life of the older guide. And I think that it's a story that kind of shows you what goes in the machine and what comes out on the other end. Like an emotion being turned into a story and being observed by a reader as something that is both the same but totally different.
Do you remember when you first encountered this book?
Yes. Slaughterhouse 5 I've read during my basic training in the army. So it was a good time, you know, to read a story about a misfit soldier who really doesn't want to kill anybody. It was really perfect timing. I read the Salinger's Nine Stories between finishing my high school and going to the army. And I think that there was something about it that felt like trying to say goodbye to my childhood or youth. It's kind of like a station or a stop on the way, because I was a kid, I was a teenager, I read this book and I went to the army. And it was strange kind of reading it at the age of 18 and already feel nostalgic for something that I still had, but I knew that I was going to lose very soon.
It's a very immersive experience reading the Salinger, because it really conjures a time and a place. 50s, often suburban world. Everything seems suffused with a pathos and a sense of drift, a sense that nothing is very stable, and also that life is very inconsequential. Uncle Wiggily in Connecticut was the story that really spoke to me most on this reading. It reads like a movie, and I think it's because he's so much about dialogue. So you really visualize these two women trapped by a snowstorm in Connecticut. And during the course of this drunken exchange, you realize that of the two women, Eloise is really revisiting her past and her longing for this young soldier that was killed in the war, blown up by a faulty Japanese gas stove. You know, she's so lost in the world, clinging to this love that is no longer. I just found it devastating.
I think that there is something in Salinger that kind of reminds me in a very strange and not direct way, some of the works of Chekhov. Mm. Because I think that when you read Chekhov, let's say the seagull, you have a feeling that there are classes, there are dynamics, but it's kind of like an end of an era. Yeah. You know, it's dying. And I have this sense with Salinger, not necessarily that the society is going to change, but that our hold in it becomes kind of slippery. And in that sense, you know, I think that in Kurt Vonnegut's book, it's very kind of outspoken and it's in your face, the trauma, the horror. And in Salinger, it's very kind of internalized and underplayed. But at the same time, I think it really gives you the same feeling that I have in the Vonnegut book, a sensitive, inquiring human being enters a society that doesn't really make that much sense. It's like a wonderful day for banana fish. For example, our protagonist, he's smart, he's witty, he's nice, he's, you know, but before the game started, he had already lost. He's kind of too good for this world or too complex for this world or, you know, too elaborate for this kind of very ungentle and soulless kind of existence around him.
As we were saying, there are very few writers who can do children better than J.D. Salinger. You also have a skill for bringing children to life on the page. So you were interviewed by the New York Times shortly after October the 7th and had just been reading to children from some of the kibbutzim. Those are the collective villages in Israel and also some communities in the north that were under attack or potential shelling from Hezbollah positions in Lebanon. That seems like a real blurring of the writer as a solitary figure who's really working on the page on his own, and the writer as a kind of social worker who is engaging with the world around him and playing a role as a therapist.
Well, I want to say that I never feel as if I'm a social worker or a therapist. I often say to my wife that I feel like I go there kind of modeling humanity, kind of being somebody who's a little bit petty, who forgets about things, who tells dumb jokes, who has those strange thoughts, just to kind of remind them that this thing still exists. You know, I read to grown-ups and read to children, and there is something sometimes much more telling when you read to children, because in most of the readings, the parents come with the children. And Shira, my wife, and I, we've been in more than one incident where you read a picture book to children, and the children are fascinated, but at some stage, some of the grown-ups start crying. And this kind of situation when a mother cries and her daughter says to her, "Oh, mom, it's not real. It's just a story. Mom, you don't cry." And it's funny because it's all kind of focused at the children, but the most heartbreaking thing is basically seeing those people who really want to be good parents, to protect their children, give them hope. And you feel that you're doing it with kind of a broken bones, you know?
Mm. Edgar Corret, thank you so much for being my guest on this episode of Shelf Life. It's been such a pleasure to talk with you today.
Thank you. Thank you. I really enjoyed our talk too.
We've been talking about Kurt Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse-5, published by Dial Press, and 9 Stories by J.D. Salinger, published by Back Bay Books. Edgar Corret's most recent collection of short stories, Fly Already, is published by Riverhead. My thanks, as always, to my producer, Ilya Maritz, and sound engineer and composer, Tim Wood. Shelf Life is a production of Grand Journal and One Grand Books in collaboration with WJFF Radio Catskill. And if you like the show, you can find plenty more on Apple and Spotify with guests such as Dylan Baker, John Waters, Ari Shapiro, Ada Zhong, and Brooke Gladstone. While you're there, why not give us a 5-star rating? It can help others find the show.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Neversink General Store, featuring catering for parties, meetings, and weddings, gourmet deli, pizzeria, and groceries inside a gas station. NeversinkGeneralStore.com, and from listeners like you.
New music just keeps on coming, from bands that have been around for many decades to first releases. New music is the power behind the development and innovation in folk music. So, next time on The Wacky Load of Monkeys with me, Graham Rice, here on Radio Catskill, it's New Music Monthly, a full hour of new folk music. Won't you join me Sunday afternoon at 3?
Looking for things to do? Check out Radio Catskill's community calendar. Find out what's happening or submit your own event. The community calendar at wjffradio.org.